They emerge from 40 leathery golf balls. The squeaking triggers the other eggs to hatch and alerts their mother.
They are caiman crocodiles, and they have a unique way of mothering their young.
The caiman crocodile mother digs the 16-centimetre hatchlings out of the nest and carries them all to the river. She'll guard them all, night and day, for a few weeks. Crocodile hatchlings can catch insects and eat snails. Their mother, babysitting, will go hungry.
Wow, that takes selfless parenting to a whole new level. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we're exploring the role of motherhood throughout the animal world, because the human concept of motherhood may be unique, but it's not the only show in town. We've got a few experts joining us today to tell us about nature's many moms. I'm going to start by turning to Pauline Cartwright. Hi, Pauline. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, Gina.
Pauline's with us from the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at KU, and she's going to tell us about a fish called a hydrozoan. So tell me sort of generally about this creature. What does it look like? Where would I find it?
So, well, actually, it's not a fish. It's an invertebrate, but they're related to jellyfish.
And
they're marine invertebrates, which live from the deep sea to the intertidal. And the actual group that I work on are called hydrozoans. And part of the reason why I study them is that they have incredibly diverse reproductive strategies and life cycles, and some of which is related to the theme of the show, which is how they take care of their young.
So, explain how that works. How do they reproduce? What's the story there?
So in general, marine invertebrates, the way that they would reproduce is called broadcast spawning. So they make a lot of eggs, make a lot of gametes, put it out into the ocean, and hope for the best. But what I found really interesting is in the group I study, which are cnidarians, so there's corals, there's jellyfish, sea anemones, and then this other group called the hydrozoans, is that in some really rare instances, instead of just spawning, they actually will brood their young.
So what does that mean, brooding?
Well, the moms will keep their eggs close, and fertilization will occur close to the mom, usually inside a cavity, and then they'll keep their young until they're ready to live independently.
So then, what happens when they're ready to live independently?
So there's a few strategies, and I think it's very interesting. There's a box jelly that will keep their young until they're little larvae, and then the larvae swim away and metamorphose into another jellyfish. There's a sea anemone that will keep the juvenile anemone polyps on its body column and really protected by the mom's tentacles. And when the baby anemones are large enough to feed and protect themselves, and they'll detach from the mom, but they usually live nearby. And the group that I study, these are it's a hydrozoan called Ectoplura. What we discovered is kind of like the anemone, the baby polyps will attach to the mom, but what is unlike the anemone is they literally fuse to the mom.
So
their tissues fuse together permanently, and they become part of a colony of polyps.
So a colony of polyps, is that a single organism or many organisms?
That's a very good question. And I think even amongst us biologists that we often, argue about what that represents.
Which side are you on?
I would say it's a single individual, because if one polyp eats, the rest of them get the nutrients. So they're sharing these resources.
So let me get this straight. The mother, spawns these babies or polyps. What is mm-hmm. the difference? Is a polyp its own organism at that point?
Yes, it is. And in fact, I just want to back up. A typical colony, like a coral colony, for example, does things very differently. They literally just bud new polyps. And this is a form of asexual reproduction. And there's just lots of polyps. And they're all genetic They're actually physically connected.
Oh, okay.
But what's unique about this ectopleura that we discovered is that it wasn't through just mom budding new polyps. It was mom making babies through sexual reproduction and then the babies fusing to the mom.
And then becoming possibly one single organism, depending on who you ask.
Exactly.
That sounds so crazy and sci-fi, if you don't mind my saying so.
Oh, I think so, too.
How recent is the discovery?
Well, we've always known, or at least for 100 years since ectopleura was described, that it was a colony. But it was always assumed that it formed more typically, you know, just budding new polyps. We published a paper 4 years ago that described this fusion of the baby polyps to the mom.
How closely are you able to just visually observe what's going on? I cannot quite picture the process of organisms fusing together.
Right. So we keep them. Actually, ectopleura is actually hard to keep in Kansas. It's a relatively large colony and it's marine. So most of these observations I've done in the field in Maine. And what we usually do is we'll find them in the field and we'll see a bunch of babies attached. We bring them into the lab, we preserve them, and then we look at them in the microscope under different phases of this fusion process.
You know, it's my understanding that most kind of crazy things a species does has something to do with its survival and perpetuation. How would you say that in this case it is the survival of the young or is the survival of the mother that is being enhanced by this process?
In this case, it's probably both. Initially, it's certainly the survival of the young because they can't even feed on their own. They don't catch food and they don't eat. And so as they're growing, mom's the one that's catching the food and providing the nutrients because at that point they share the same digestive system. Later on, you have an organism with multiple mouths that's increasing the chances that they can catch food and eat.
Whoa. So multiple mouths in a single digestive system?
Correct.
Wow. Okay. So does this seem to work pretty well for these creatures?
Yeah, I think it does. And in fact, if you look at this whole group of hydrozoans, this ectopleura is one of the largest colonies, and it is incredibly abundant along shallow water coastal regions.
Does our awareness that the hydrozoan is capable of reproducing and rearing its young this way, does that change our understanding of biology and the natural world in any fundamental way?
Well, I mean, the one thing I love about science is the more you know, the more questions you have. And in this case, how do we define an individual that actually each of the individual members of the polyps are not genetically identical? So I think it does make us think about what we call an individual and how these polyps can coordinate even though they're not really originate from part of the same genome.
Are you a mother?
Yes, I am.
As you study the hydrozoan's unique parenting style in this whole, like, literal attachment between parent and child, do you ever think about the differences between you and them?
Funny you should ask. I was actually, when I was thinking about this show and talking to people about doing this, I suddenly realized that it was pretty ironic, the research that I study, that ectopleura literally physically attaches to their mother and stays there permanently. And I was finding myself being a little bit envious because I'm at the point in my life where my eldest child is about to go to college and I'm experiencing that separation. And ectopleura, of course, doesn't have those kinds of emotions. They don't even have a brain. So I was feeling a little of the injustice of that.
Are there other underwater moms, invertebrate underwater moms we should know about?
Like I said, most of them really just spawn their gametes out into the water. Some survive. Most do not.
But you win some, you lose some.
Yes, exactly. But this brooding type behavior, which is rare, in terms of species numbers, is actually common amongst the groups. So there are snails that do it, and like I said, there are sea anemones and various jellyfish and other mollusks that have this type of behavior.
What's your favorite thing about observing this process? I mean, is there something, some very specific aspect of it that just fascinates you?
Well, to study hydrozoans in general, what fascinates me is the diversity of approaches that they take, both in their life cycles and how they reproduce and take care of their young. And basically, the more I learn about it, the more different types of strategies that I find. In fact, what I often like to say is there's basically very little that a cnidarian cannot do.
Thanks, Pauline.
Thank you.
Pauline Cartwright has joined us from KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, where she studies the mouth-brooding hydrozoan. Central Standard's going to take a short break. When we return, we'll hear about a fish that keeps its young in its mouth, and we'll visit a few zoo animals, too, plus poetry. That's all coming up after the break. Stay with us. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to Central Standard. Mother's Day is coming up, and in honor of the holiday, we're learning about motherhood throughout the animal world. After hearing about the hydrozoan's mothering style, I am feeling like I got a good deal being human, and I'll have to do something extra nice for my mom to show gratitude for getting to exist as a separate being. Now, let's hear about another underwater creature, Leo Smith, also joining us from KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Good morning.
Hi, Gina.
Tell me about the cichlid.
So there's a lot of different species of fish will actually mouth brood. So this is where a parent will, after the eggs are fertilized, they'll either take the eggs or even sometimes the baby fishes themselves, and they'll hold them in their mouths to protect them. For the most part, in the fish world, you'll see that this happens where the male is actually the one taking care of it. But in the cichlids, both in Africa and South America, you'll have species where the mother will actually be the one that is sort of holds the fish in their mouth, you know, often for weeks. And then eventually, even in the South American ones, they'll hold the babies in their mouth for an additional amount of time after that. And so cichlids, just if people are familiar with them, these are things like tilapia that we eat, as well as a bunch of the popular aquarium fishes, such as the angelfishes, discuses, Jack Dempsey's, and Oscars.
People probably know what a tilapia looks like on a plate, but what do these cichlids look like in the water? About how big are they?
So cichlids are probably one of the two or three most successful groups of fishes. So they're really, really varied in size and shape. So these can be as small as maybe an inch and sort of look like your standard, what I refer to as like a Joe fish, you know, like average looking. They can go up as the angel fishes can be almost like a kite or diamond shape. And then you have big round discus, and the largest cichlids are probably, you know, approaching maybe a foot, maybe 15, 16 inches long.
So what kind of mother are all of the fish within the cichlid group? Are they all pretty similar in their mothering style, or do we need to distinguish between them?
Right. So that's a really good question. And it's actually one of the reasons why so many people study cichlids. So most fish, it's not entirely all that different than what Pauline talked about, where they'll kind of just spread their sperm and eggs all over, and they'll fertilize and they'll go off into the wild. When you get into cichlids, most of them have like a sticky egg, so they'll actually deposit their eggs either in a nest or on a structure, and then the male will come by and fertilize them. In the case of cichlids, once as you sort of go into the different sort of groups of cichlids, you sort of repeatedly evolve mouth brooding. Sometimes that'll be where the mother takes care of them. That's sort of the dominant case in cichlids. But there's also cases where the male does it, and there's some where the male and female do it. But
so
primitively, they...
Yeah, describe it in a little more detail, though, this mouth brooding. Because, so that's basically just keeping your babies in your mouth?
Right. So in the female mouth brooding ones, so the mothers that we're talking about today, the mom will lay down the eggs like sort of in a on a surface or something like that. The male will come by and fertilize them. In some cases, the male will actually fertilize them while they're in the mouth. And the reason for this is to try and ensure that, like, at any given time as these animals are reproducing, they're vulnerable to attack because they can't defend a territory, or something could come in because the eggs are so nutritious, or, you know, a delicacy, or however you want to think about that. They're trying to protect every last egg, right? So they're going to take every, and that sort of conveys as they go into the mouth brooding. So after they're fertilized, she'll like literally hold them in her mouth. Some fish are capable of eating while they do it. For the most part, most don't. So they're going to have, the mom is going to like, not waste away, but she's going to have a serious hit to her nutrition. She's going to start starving for 10, 14 days. And she'll just be rolling them around in her mouth, sort of keeping them from getting fungus or anything growing on them. And she'll actually be able to somehow tell. We don't really know how they do this, but the female can tell which ones are fertilized and which ones aren't. And she'll slowly swallow all of the unfertilized eggs.
Whoa.
And so that's kind of interesting. And then on top of that, if they have a, if a large number of them get sort of taken during that initial phase, somehow if like 10 or 20 or 30%, if it's not a very successful reproductive effort, she'll actually swallow them all and do the process, start the reproductive process all over. There's some sort of cue that if it's not going well, they know it and they don't want to delay reproduction for that year.
I don't mean to get hung up on a detail, but it seems hard to me to, I mean, from a human mouth perspective, to be able to swallow one thing in your mouth and not other things in your mouth.
So that's actually a really interesting point. So fish, we tend to think of chewing with our, what in fish land we would call an oral teeth, right? We chew with our teeth that are in the front of the mouth. But fish actually chew with what they're called pharyngeal teeth, which are in their throat. So these are what actually make up the bones of our, like, our voice box and things like that. And because they have this, they don't, you know, so the oral teeth are more about scraping algae or, you know, like if it's your predator, you're going to trap the predator and kind of hold it down. So they can actually manipulate things in their throat in a way that we don't, because those throat teeth have all these muscles that kind of, you know, are not exactly, you know, they're not as sensitive as our fingers or something like that, but they have a lot more control. And cichlids in particular actually have a modified pharyngeal jaw system that allows them even finer control than you'd see in almost any other group of fish. And so they can basically roll them around very particularly and then eventually find them and throw them back down their gullet.
With this whole mouth brooding thing, is it possible to, like, let them out to play for a while and then call them back home?
Yeah, so exactly. So when you're in the South American cichlids called the earth eaters or geophagous fishes, those species actually will let the, once they've hatched, so the, initially they're just eggs, so they're fertilized, they're splitting up into multiple cells, eventually becoming a little tiny fish or a fry. And so in those guys, what they'll do is they'll basically let them out to play. You'll see them, you know, I don't know, play is maybe not the right word, but they'll be feeding, they'll be kind of learning the habitat. But the second the mom senses any sort of like danger or, you know, any sort of thing coming, she'll actually send physical chemical cues through the water and behavioral cues, various signaling and other things, where the babies will immediately come back in her mouth. And she'll also, fishes have incredible suction power. So they'll, you know, it's a combination of them swimming towards her and her just sucking it in like a straw. She'll be able to pull all the babies back into her mouth where she'll protect them. And the reason they do all this is that it's sort of, in biology, when you broadcast spawn, like we see with a lot of these things, you have lots and lots of babies and you sort of forget that they exist. And you know, you're more relying on the sheer numbers for success. Whereas in cichlids or in the hydrozoans that Pauline were talking about, if you put more investment, the same way that humans put investment into their kids, what the cichlids are doing with this is they have fewer, larger babies, and they're making sure that they survive into the next generation. So it's more like, you know, an eggs in basket kind of, more eggs in the basket kind of situation where they have, you know, maybe half as many or even a tenth of as many babies, and that they're trying everything in their power to ensure the success of those young.
This might be kind of a big question, but what accounts for the differences in mothering styles across species? I mean, just that some creatures are having tons of babies they don't even know, and others are investing a lot of energy into, like, a couple of them. What accounts for all of these kinds of differences?
It's going to just be natural selection. So natural selection is going to favor one group. So if you have a group and where they're all sort of something in between. I mean, primitively everything broadcasts spawn. The simplest creatures on Earth will reproduce their, you know, release their eggs and sperm into the water, and then over time, if one group has more success because they take care of their young, you'll see a gradual increase in parenting. But only in cases where it sort of increases the survivalship of the young into the next generation. But you can see why that would happen. I mean, if you can get a couple, ensure that a few make it, you're going to have a lot more, you know, you're basically guaranteeing their survival outside of odd chances, just like humans, you know.
If you were to say that the mouth brooding technique we've been talking about with cichlids makes some aspect of survival or thriving a priority, what would you say that it is?
With the cichlids, what you're doing is, you know, because of all the are you asking like what? Could you repeat the question, I guess?
Yeah, I don't know. In human life, I guess we have their sort of parenting priorities. And I'm wondering if the mouth brooding technique really puts a premium on something.
So that's an interesting question. I guess they're trying to protect the young at any cost, right? And so this actually manifests itself with some really strange interactions with other species. And so they're not putting a whole lot of thought into it, I guess is how I'll word that. And the example I'll use is there's actually a catfish in one of the African lakes that basically acts like a cuckoo bird, where it'll come in and it'll release its fertilized eggs right where the mom cichlid is taking care of them, and she'll suck them into her mouth and she'll take care of them. And as that catfish hatches first, and then it eats all of the babies of the cichlid, and then it'll then thrive and survive. But yet that cichlid will still take care of that catfish, thinking it's its own. So there's not I wouldn't put a whole lot of thought into the fish. It's a very instinctive behavior. They're just going to take care of whatever young are in front of them. And so even at the expense of losing all of their sort of brood for this, you know, this invasive or cuckoo parasite catfish, basically.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the movie Finding Nemo? What kind of fish is Nemo? And is that basically a story that could really happen minus the talking and stuff?
So Finding Nemo is that's a clownfish. And clownfishes are actually really closely related to cichlids. And so they have similar sort of reproductive behaviors where they have these sticky eggs where the parent will take care of the eggs. The complication in Finding Nemo and the reason it might not sort of work long term is that instead of having males and females like we normally sort of imagine as humans or mammals, the largest clownfish on any sea anemone is a female, and all the other ones you see there are male, with only one of those generally reproducing with the female. And if you manually pluck out the female from the population, the largest male will transition, because they're hermaphrodites, it'll turn into a female, and the second largest male will become the breeding male. And so in Finding Nemo, what would generally have happened would be that when Coral, the mom, dies, Marlin, the father, would then become the mom, and Nemo would then start to mate with Marlin.
That is a pretty wild story.
It would be it probably wouldn't be appropriate for Disney.
This whole idea of, with the mouth brooding, of a mother not being able to eat for a pretty extended period of time, you said that her nutrition takes a hit. How does that affect, does that have long-term consequences? Can she die from that?
They certainly are going to be hampered, and you have to take that into account. So if we had a human, let's say, that was starved twice a year, every year, there would be long-term effects, right? So she's taking a hit on her long-term survival, like, or the species in general, not just her, like the females in general. If they are constantly going through this starvation, non-starvation diet, it is harmful. It does prolong, you know, it probably diminishes their lifespan and certain aspects of their fitness and success.
Does it make them grumpy?
I don't tend to think of it's a good question, but I don't think that they're capable of exactly those kind of behaviors. Although cichlids are pretty behavior rich as far as fish go. But I do think that it's a trade-off. Like anything in evolution, this has proven to be successful, and so they keep doing it. And it has repeatedly evolved. So despite the fact that it's only found in cichlids, we think that it's the female mouth brooding's evolved 8 to 10 times. We don't know why cichlids are the only group that this has happened in. There's lots of possible reasons. But it is interesting that once this was possible, that this just keeps happening over and over again in this really species-rich group.
Will you be thinking about cichlids this Mother's Day?
Sure. After this, I'm sure I will be.
We're doing a lot of anthropomorphizing now, and I'll just acknowledge that. But even just from a metaphorical standpoint, are there lessons to learn from your observations of these fish?
I think if I were to have any sort of the fact that we have so many fish, some of the most successful fish in the world. So there's probably over 1,000 species of cichlids in Lake Malawi and Lake Victoria. And every single one of them is a female mouth brooder. And if you think about the fact that there's 1,000 species in just two, you know, they're very large lakes, and that it was super successful for them, and that that represents, you know, 2 or 3% of all fish on Earth are doing this in these two lakes, it probably says that this is something, you know, that there's value in maternal take, you know, basically maternal care. And since humans and, you know, my mom and wife are mothers, you know, it's, you know, there's super value in this, and we should make sure that we thank our mothers this holiday weekend.
Aw. Well, thanks so much for sharing that story with us, Leo.
Sure.
William Leo Smith studies cichlids in KU's Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. Now we've got a guy who can talk to us about lots of mothering styles from the animal world. He's the director of living collections at the Kansas City Zoo. Sean Putney, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. That is a pretty crazy title you've got, director of living collections. Do you think of all those animals in the zoo as a collection?
It's a very long title. It's basically just saying that I'm in charge of the animal department. Yeah, it does kind of conform to everything. We have so many species at the zoo. It kind of rings a bell as far as what I do.
Yeah. Is there an animal at the zoo whose mothering style has really caught your attention?
Well, I think when we talk about mothering styles, it's interesting to hear the other guests talk because we have things that they are working with at the zoo, too. So it makes sense to me when we're talking about this stuff. But we have a wide variety of animals at the zoo. We have our own mouth brooders and cardinal fish, Bangai cardinal fish at the Hillsburg Penguin Plaza. We have jellyfish there as well. They don't brood, but the moon jellies are a relative of the hydrozoans that we were talking about before. But the ones that really seem to grab everybody's attentions are the ones that are more closely related to us, like the orangutans and the chimps and the gorillas.
Tell me about the orangutans. I am guessing that we have more in common with them in terms of mothering style than with the hydrozoan or a cichlid.
Definitely. The orangs are very similar to us in that they put a lot of energy into their young, and they are very caring. They'll take care of, they'll usually feed their infants for up to 5 years. They might hang out with mom until they're 13 or 14 years old. So there's a lot of care that goes into that and a lot of energy as opposed to a coral that's just releasing their gametes into the water. So there's definite benefits of it, but there's a lot of energy that's being put into it.
Do you have any stories about parent-child relationships in the orangutan world?
We do. We do. In fact, Kaylee John is our youngest that we have at the zoo, and it's an interesting story. Zoos have evolved with the times, and over the past 30 or 40 years, it used to be if a mom wasn't taking care of its youngster, we would immediately pull that animal and hand raise it. But we found over the years that that can harm that animal as it gets older because it feels like it's more human as opposed to being an orangutan. So when Kaylee John was born, her mom wasn't taking very good care of her. And so we did make the decision to pull her. And
can I just ask you, what does it mean for an orangutan to not take very good care of her young? What did that look like?
For her mom, it was she put her on top of her head and just kind of had her there for a while. In fact, we let her try to do her thing for a while, but there was no maternal instinct at all. And she had babies in the past before and had similar things. So this is kind of her last effort to try to be a mom. So she wasn't doing a very good job. So we inserted ourselves and we did 24-hour care on her. We wore little hairy vests to act as if we were orangutans ourselves. If she had to go, she went. And we did that for about 6 months. And at the same time, we were training one of the other orangutans that had been a mother before to present herself up to the front of the holding exhibits so that when the time came, our plan was to reintroduce her to this surrogate mom. And it was obviously she didn't have a baby at the time, so she did not have milk, so we'd have to get some nutrients to her. So our plan was to train mom at the same time we were trying to get baby to the point where she could hold on and do the things that a young orang would do. But mom would have to bring her up to be fed on a regular basis. So our whole goal in the thing was to make sure we got the mom to the point where she was ready to be a surrogate, and the baby to the point where she was strong enough to hold on, fend for herself. That was about 6 months. We were one of the earliest to be able to put a youngster back with a surrogate. So we're really proud of that.
So the idea of maternal instinct is kind of interesting, because that implies that just across species, you're born with this, just you have an inborn ability to know what to do when you step into that role. And it sounds like that's not necessarily the case. Like, sometimes you need help.
Definitely. I would say it's very similar to us in this circumstance, especially in that some animals do a very good job at being moms, being dads, and others do not. And we step in when we feel we have to. But the overall goal is to try to get the animals to be the best parents that they can. Now, that being said, there are some animals, as the previous guests noted, that there's no parental instinct at all. If you're a coral, if you're a frog, a toad, most frogs and toads are just laying their eggs and off on your own.
About birds?
Depends on the birds. Most birds are usually very good parents, but it's a very short period of time. A great example is we have some Humboldt penguin chicks right now being raised by their parents, and they do a very good job, but it's usually birds grow extremely quickly. In fact, our penguin chicks are growing between 10 and 25% body weight every day. So they put a great deal of energy into raising their chicks, but it's only going to be for a few months, and then they get to be about adult size, and at that point they cut themselves off.
Does your work at the zoo observing other animals give you perspective on your own human relationships, even your own family relationships?
I would say it depends on the animals. Certainly when you start looking at the primates and the great apes specifically, yes, you can see that there's a great deal of similarity between the two. It's really nice and neat to see how well they take care of their kids. But there are differences too, especially with the orangs and the chimps. We have a young chimp right now out on an exhibit, and they have to fend for themselves pretty quickly. They have to hold on. They're very strong. If they fell off, they have to be more durable. So there are a great amount of similarities. And yes, I do think about that stuff sometimes, but there are also a lot of differences.
Would you say that, is there anything you can identify as universal in motherhood, or is that just an insane concept?
I don't think you can say a universal motherhood ideology, just because there's so many differences in how animals are raised or not raised at all, depending on the species.
Part of what I get from your stories and our other guest stories is that parenting, I mean, I think human parents think of their challenges as very particular, like it's challenging because of hectic schedules or modern demands or things like that. But it's fascinating to me how challenging parenthood is for other creatures, too. It's like that it's hard work and things go wrong sometimes.
Yeah, the difference is it's hard work in both circumstances, but if the parents don't do a good job for these animals in the wild, their offspring probably won't be around very much longer, as opposed to us making a mistake here and there. We have a lot of backup systems in place. So it's very brutal in the wild. So if a chick is left unattended or a young orangutan is left by itself, chances are nature's going to have its way.
Pauline, Leo, do you guys want to weigh in on this idea of being a mother is challenging no matter what species you are?
Well, I guess the name of the game in nature is to reproduce and to have offspring that can live to then reproduce and pass your genes on. And in that way, I would say that's universal amongst all living things, and that's the challenge. And where they differ is the strategy that each individual species chooses to take.
Leo?
Right, and I would say that the one thing to keep in mind is that given that mammals have mammary glands, which is what provides the food for them, in the fish world, it's usually the male that's dominating, that's kind of taking on the the care role usually. And as you work through all life outside of vertebrates, you know, it's not always going to be the mom. I mean, I think it's very easy for us to get focused in on the mom because that is so sort of near and dear to our hearts.
But, or because it's Mother's Day.
Yeah, well, sure. But it's you can't have a uniform view of motherhood if a lot of the time it's the dad's doing the same thing, or in some cases the mom and dad. You know, there's plenty of organisms where the mom and dad is the same individual.
You know, Sean, do you have a favorite mother-baby story from your time at the zoo? Something like really cute and cuddly for us to go out on?
I think I just told you my
the cutest, cuddliest.
The cutest one that is dear to my heart. But I did just tell you also about our chimpanzees. And they are a very dramatic group, but it's interesting to watch how not only mom is taking care of them, but the entire troop, how they interact with each other. And it's very much like relatives coming in to see one of our kids in the hospital when it was born.
Tell me about it. Describe it in some more detail. What do they do?
Well, mom is very protective, and she'll sit there and she'll allow some to come by and see. There are others that she might be more wary about. And then gradually she'll kind of increase the number of animals that she'll allow to come over and see. So it's almost like original family, or close family, and then extended family, and then relatives, and then it goes on and on. But it is very interesting, very, very dramatic, and very close-knit group.
What do you think is the purpose of this sort of procession that creatures do? I mean, that's interesting to me, that the way we go visit in a hospital, that whole procession happens among other groups too. Is that part of initiation into a group or something?
I think some of it is that. I do think a lot of it is protection too, because there are, even if it's a group that has been together for years and years, the name of the game is survival. As the other guests were saying, you want your genes to be passed on, and if you aren't cautious enough, then that youngster is not going to survive. So the whole thing is, do I feel that this baby is protected enough, and do I feel safe for it? That's how I view it when they're going through all that.
Do you have any big unanswered questions about mothering in the animal world as you observe so many different creatures at the zoo? Just something that you're dying to know?
Well, I heard this when I was first in the business. The only predictable thing about animals is their unpredictability. So the second you think that you figured it all out, whether it be with one species or a family or an entire group of organisms, then something new appears. And that's the neat thing about science. That's the neat thing about working in zoos. My job is never the same from day to day. When I go in, there's always going to be something different, which makes it fun. So I can sit here and tell you that there's one thing that I know is going to happen, and then the very next day it won't. So that's, to me, that's fun.
Will you be helping out any moms when you go back to the zoo today?
Well, we have a gorilla who's expecting, but it's not for another month yet. So we're well in preparations. We're making sure that we have our birthing plans all together and make sure we have all of our ducks in a row, so to speak.
What does a birthing plan for a gorilla involve?
It's making sure that taking care of all the ifs and whats, if this, then what. And very similar to when our orangutan was born 7 years ago, we were very prepared. If things didn't go well, what are we going to do? At what point are we going to step in if need be? Now, hopefully none of these things will happen, but we have to be prepared.
Well, safe birthing to the gorilla, and thanks for heading in from the zoo this morning. It's been fun talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Sean Putney is the Director of Living Collections at the Kansas City Zoo.